Welcome to the Emmy Mui Show. Today's topic is about sacred Britain and tours to Britain. Our guest today is Glenn Broughton, and he is with Cameron Broughton. They lead tours to Britain. And their website is www.sacredbritain.com. That's spelled BRITAIN.com. So welcome, Glenn.
Thank you, Amelia.
Welcome to the show, and thank you for being on the show. So, tell me, what is Sacred Britain?
So many people are attracted to visit Britain, England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, because there seems to be something special about the land. And so I personally, living in England, I was drawn to visit the sacred sites quite a number of years ago. And then a friend asked me if I would lead a tour group, and it was such a powerful, transformative experience for everyone that it just sort of carried on every year. and we're now planning our 13th year of tours for 2008.
The thing is that being from Britain doesn't make you necessarily a tour guide, so you must be somewhat special to lead tours.
Well, I think one of the... It's strange. I didn't know until I got probably into my 30s that my birthday, September 29th, is the Michaelmas Day, which is St. Michael's Feast Day. And the most powerful and most well-known ley line in England is called the St. Michael Line, which runs from the southwest Cornwall across to the east coast. And I just kept finding myself drawn to these sacred sites on this line again and again. And when I realized what day I'd been born on, it sort of started to make sense. And I had a friend who was training as a crystal healer. I got interested in the properties of crystals, and it all just seemed to sort of make sense and fit into a new direction for my life. I'd had a business, and that business, the recession came, and that business folded, and so I was looking for a new direction, and the new direction really found me rather than me finding it.
So how often are your tours? Tell me about it, because I'm sure our listeners, including myself, are interested in these tours.
The tours take place from spring through to autumn. So normally around, I think next year, our first tour is going to be end of March, beginning of April, and that's Celtic Britain and the Power of Place. Because Celtic Britain, it's a very old land, and there are sacred sites that are so ancient. The stone circles there, for example, everyone has heard of Stonehenge. That's around about 5,000 years old, and it's possible if you visit these sacred sites, the stone circles, the holy wells, the underground chambers. There are many, many different types of sacred sites. If you visit them, you will find that actually they're not dead relics of a bygone age. They're actually still potent and alive with energy today because they're fed with currents. At each sacred site is an upwelling of earth energy. And that is why the sacred site builders chose those places. So we take people to the sites that are still potent and can be used today. So we go to stone circles. Of course, we always take people in Stonehenge. We get special access to go in outside of the normal visitors' hours so we can actually enter into the circle, touch the stones, and have it to ourselves for an hour. And we do that on all our tours. Celtic Britain and Spirit of Place follows that Michael Ley line I was telling you about. And then in the summer, end of July, beginning of August, we also do a couple of tours which visit the sacred sites, but also the modern enigma of crop circles that occur each year anew. So we have ancient mysteries, and we also have very modern mysteries. And next year, for the first time, we're also doing a tour to Ireland and one to the Western Isles of Scotland, which we're very excited about.
You mentioned quite a few things, talking about, for one thing, Stonehenge. Is that one of your most popular destinations?
Yes, you know, I think if we didn't take people to Stonehenge, we'd get lynched. Everyone's heard about Stonehenge. Some people have dreamt of going into Stonehenge their whole lives, and it is a wonderful experience. One of the reasons we, I don't know if you know, but if you just visit Stonehenge, you're actually kept back about 30 feet behind a rope. You're not allowed to enter within the stones. You're not allowed to touch them. You can just view them from this 30-foot distance. But we get special permission to take groups in either before it's open to the public for the day or in the evening. And we can actually go inside. We can stand in the center of Stonehenge. We can do a ceremony. A ceremony's been performed there for the last 5,000 years. We can take part in this continuous lineage, if you like, and we can utilize the energy which is there. We don't know what ceremonies were conducted, but we can have a good idea. So Stonehenge is something that most people want to do.
And in connection with Stonehenge, I know that the crop circles have been cropping up across from Stonehenge every summer.
That's right.
And every summer, is there usually two or three crop circles across from Stonehenge every summer, or is it just one every summer?
It's always unpredictable. This year there weren't any.
Really?
Yeah.
So what was the speculation behind that?
Well,
you can make something up.
The numbers this year were slightly down. This year in England there were 52 crop circles. Last year there were 56. The year before there were 75. So numbers have gone down in the last couple of years, but the quality of the designs and patterns has been fantastic. So the actual location, what has remained the same, and I suspect always will be, is that the majority of crop circles in England are within a 10-mile radius of Avebury Stone Circle. Now, a lot of people may not have heard of Avebury Stone Circle, but it's actually the largest stone circle in the world. It's much, much bigger than Stonehenge. It's not so glamorous or photogenic because it doesn't have those lintels on the top, and it's so huge it has a diameter of 1/4 mile, and there's part of a village inside it, so it's difficult to sort of perceive it in a one shot in the same way you can with Stonehenge. But it actually was and still is really the main ceremonial site of the Neolithic people in England, that is the New Stone Age people. And when I use that phrase, I ought to just qualify it, because, you know, when we think about Stone Age, people think about cavemen acting so pretty barbarically, and that nothing could be further from the truth. These sites were built with such a knowledge of not only construction techniques, a knowledge of the earth and the energies present, and the knowledge of the energetic properties of the particular stones they used, and also a tremendous understanding of the movement of the planets and the bodies up in the heavens, because all sacred sites pretty much are astronomically aligned. So I suppose, again, I've gone full circle there.
Yes. So going back to the Stonehenge, so how do you coordinate your tours? Because there's an expectation that you're going to see maybe a few crop circles near Stonehenge, and it doesn't happen. How does that whole thing work where you're, I don't know what you call it, chasing crop circles?
We stay in a hotel right in the heart of crop circle country that is very close to Avebury. Stonehenge is just 20 miles away. So when we go to Stonehenge, if there's a crop circle, we'll certainly visit it. If one occurs after we've made our visit to Stonehenge, we'll go back and visit it. Our crop circle tours are always unpredictable because we never know what's going to occur overnight. The crop circles just appear overnight, and we are linked into an information network of people who phone around and pass on information of new formations, and the police are involved in this as well. People report if they see a new one. So normally by 9-10 o'clock in the morning, we know if there's been a new crop circle that night, and we go straight to it and see if we can get permission to enter.
Do you have any unusual stories about the formations of some of these? Okay, why don't we take a break, and we'll take a break. I'm here with Glenn Broughton from Sacred Britain Tours, and we're talking about Stonehenge and crop circles. I am Emmy Louie. You're listening to the Emmy Louie Show, and we will be back. Welcome back. I am Emmy Louie. We are here with Glenn Broughton from Sacred Britain Tours, and we're talking about chasing crop circles around Stonehenge in Britain. So, Glenn, tell me a very unusual story about what happens because of the nature of off-the-cuff or in-the-moment kind of preparation to see these crop circles.
Well, one of the most remarkable things that happened to me is a few years ago, someone had asked me if I would lead a tour to sacred sites and crop circles, and I was talking. She was from the United States, and this was back at Easter time, and I had this very strong feeling that there would be something very special happen in a particular field called Eastfield. Eastfield is the field that's had more crop circles than anywhere else on the planet. Every year it gets between 1 and 4 crop circles in it. And it's very close to Avebury Stone Circle. Well, the tour started. It was a 10-day tour, and day 8 came, and there still wasn't a crop circle in Eastfield. But it felt, and the best phrase I can use is, it felt like the field was pregnant with a formation just about to drop. That's how it felt to me. And there was a crop circle in the field across the little road. So we decided to do an experiment. The members of this group got together, and we stood in this crop circle across the field in Northfield and looked across at Eastfield. And we put out an invitation to the circle makers. Whoever or whatever that might mean to each individual, and we asked that the circle makers join with us to co-create a crop formation that would have something to teach us. Now, there were 19 members of this group, but for one reason or another, 5 people didn't take part in this experiment. And we did this meditation for about 10 minutes. We didn't choose a particular pattern. We didn't want it to be a party trick, just something that would have a lesson to teach us. And after the meditation, nothing was there. We went off, and the next day we drove to Eastfield, 9 o'clock in the morning, and there was a crop circle. We were just so excited, and we went into it, and it was absolutely gorgeous. The flow was beautiful, but we couldn't work out what the pattern was, because when you stand in them on the ground, it's difficult to see. So we hired helicopters and flew over it from the air, and what it turned out to be was a flower of life. Now, I don't know if your listeners are aware, but a flower of life is made up of 19 overlapping and interlinked circles. This one was incomplete, and it had 5 missing, just like the number of members in our group.
Whoa. Hello.
Yes. Makes the hairs on the back of your neck stand up.
Well, it was already standing up, but I didn't know it was going to get this personal.
And you know, we've repeated that with different groups.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
Now.
Okay, it's hitting home now, what you just said.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go on with that story.
Well, so what really, as I said, we've repeated this with different groups over the years, and every time we do a meditation, a crop formation appears. I did it about 3 years ago. I was the keynote speaker at the American Society of Dowsers annual convention in Vermont, and I ran a 2-day crop circle workshop, and at the end of that, people said, I told that story, and people said, oh, can we do that now? It was June time, you know, it's time when crop circles could occur. So I said, sure, I don't think there's ever been one in Vermont, but we can try. And we did. And to do this, we went outside. The dowsers had built a double spiral labyrinth in the grounds of the college where the conference was taking place. We sat in the middle where the two labyrinths joined, and we did the same thing. We put an invitation to the circle makers. 1 hour later, in England, a double labyrinth crop circle appeared. So what I have to think is that I don't know who or what makes the crop circles, but it is something, probably, I think it has to be a consciousness that we are able to interact with. In other words, they can actually pick up our thoughts and signals that we might send to them.
Okay, I'm stunned, but we need to move on. Stunned. So, you said, let me recap what you just said. You said for Eastfield, there were 19 members with you, and 14 participated, 5 did not.
Yes.
And then the next day, there was a flower of life with 19 circles in that flower of life, and 5 of the circles were missing.
Correct.
So, was that a pivotal moment in your life, or what?
It was. It certainly was. And I have to tell you, we were all in tears. I mean, it was so...
You were all in tears? Even the men?
Yeah, even the men. We were all standing
even
there
the most
in tears.
Skeptical of the men, or were there any skeptics? I'm sure there probably wasn't, because...
Well, a couple of the people who hadn't taken part in the experiment didn't take part because they were skeptical. But when they saw what had happened the next day, everybody just said, okay, I believe now. This is some phenomenon which is beyond our understanding, but there is something really special going on here.
You must have just... I'm sure you wanted to take a picture of the look on the skeptic faces.
Yes. It's when something like that happens to you, and, you know, I mean, I tell that story to you, but I could actually tell you 20 stories like that.
How about another one that's a little different?
I'll tell you about my very first crop circle I went into, because actually I'd never seen a crop circle. I'd never been to a crop circle, but I was involved in visiting sacred sites and doing earth energy healing work. That is, visiting sites which, when I got there, by tuning into the site, I was able to perceive that the energies of the sites weren't as they should be, and this can often happen through human interference. This particular site, for example, had in the past had a castle built on it and had had a military function for quite a number of times.
Which site is it called?
Sorry?
I'm sorry, what site was it called?
The site is actually called Merlin's Mound.
Okay.
And it's in Marlborough in Wiltshire in England.
Mm-hmm.
And It's known about, but not a lot of people visit it because it's actually on private grounds. It's within the grounds of a private school. And I went along there and really felt drawn to do some energy healing and clearing work. And after I'd done that, it was a very powerful experience. It was certainly the most powerful experience in my life to that point. I won't go into details because it's a long story, but suffice to say, when I'd finished doing the work there, I just needed to go and ground myself, and I thought, I'll drive out and I'll sit in a field. So I just drove down the road, pulled into the first farmer's driveway, got out of the car, and there was my first crop circle. And I'd been working with the balancing the yin-yang or masculine-feminine earth energies. And this particular crop circle that I went into contained a crescent moon and a sun. So the solar and lunar, the masculine-feminine energies.
I could see how it could be a very personal story.
So on the tours, Emily-Louis, what we try and do is introduce people to some of these secrets which are held in the landscape. I mentioned the one there about the balance of the masculine, feminine, or yin-yang energies within each of us. You know, both men and women have yin-yang or masculine, feminine energies. The yin or the feminine is the intuitive gut feeling, knowing, the heart center, which we tend to, or historically in our society, has been less valued and put down, and our society has been very patriarchal, very logically minded, very masculine in its thinking. And we need both. The way Chachi Gawain put it very beautifully a number of years ago in one of her books, when she said, it's like Your logical mind is great at working out how to get somewhere, but it doesn't for the life of it know which is the best place for you to go. Your intuition and your heart center will tell you from some source that we're not sort of consciously necessarily aware of, hey, I really need to go to this place. For example, you know, for me it was, I need to go to Merlin's Mound. And I didn't know why, but I followed that intuition. And my logical mind then kicked in and said, okay, I can get you there. I'm going to get a road map, and we turn left on this road, and we turn right, and that will... And the logical mind is great to get you there. And then it opens the door for magic to happen. And so we try on our tours to open the door for magic to happen for people, and it often does.
That is so awesome. Tell me about... So you've got several other things, of course. Not several, you've got many other things. So tell me about the holy wells. Tell me about that, because here, even in North Carolina, I remember that people do go to these sites and they take water from these sites as far away as Britain.
Yes.
Is that possible? Is that legal?
Yes, I think as long as it's in your check-in luggage and not in your carry-on.
I know. Can you imagine that? The having it confiscated because it might be drinking water? tell me some things about holy wells.
Well, the holy wells are wonderful. For years, I mean, throughout history, as long as people can remember, the wells have been revered as sacred sites, as places of healing. People would go, women would go, for example, to take the waters for fertility issues. If they wanted to get pregnant, there was sort of a ritual that they would do at the holy wells. Many accounts of people taking their children there to be cured of different ailments, particularly, interestingly, conditions of relating to the eye and the eyesight. they found that the water from the holy wells was particularly beneficial for eyesight. And I think this is one of these occasions when information has been passed down in story form, and it takes a slightly different, we don't have to interpret it literally. I don't know that the holy wells were particularly beneficial for physical eyesight, but I think it was a remembrance of the fact that the going to do ceremony and take the water at holy wells was good for your spiritual vision, possibly for clairvoyance, and possibly for clearing the way so you could see your spiritual path more clearly. I mean, there were certainly physical benefits as well. And how that happens, it's actually very scientific and very logical for those of a logical mind, because those upwellings of energy, the earth, if you imagine the earth, it's a huge ball, it's spinning, and it has an iron center. So the latest scientific belief is that the center of the earth is a huge crystalline iron mass. They don't believe it's molten anymore. They used to. Now they think it's a huge mass of crystalline iron, and it's spinning. We're spinning at 1,100 miles an hour, and the Earth's gravity is almost like a ring of magnets ringing the Earth. And so actually what you've got is a generator. When you have an electric generator, you have an iron rod, and you spin it within a ring of magnets, it generates electricity. That's what the Earth does. It's a huge generator of electromagnetism. That electromagnetism comes to the surface via the path of least resistance, as all electricity does. That is one of two things, well, three things, really. Underground water, geological fault lines, and beds of crystal. So it's known, for example, that under every sacred site in the world, and this includes the pyramids in the deserts of Cairo outside Giza, every sacred site in the world has underground water beneath it. And not just underground water, but underground water which is potentized with these currents of earth energy. And so the energy wants to come to the surface. It follows the water courses. If it comes out in the surface, that is why a holy well works, because you're actually drinking water which is potentized with earth energy currents. The frequency of the earth is between 8 and 9 hertz, and that is the same frequency we attain when we go into a deep meditation, into an alpha state. And so when we take in this water, it is bringing us into a deeply balanced state which is conducive with meditation.
Sounds good. So I see on your website you have gorgeous pictures. I know on the top is Stonehenge. I'm sure you're very familiar with these pictures. Tell me about some of these locations here.
We have Tintagel Castle is on there, which is the birthplace of King Arthur.
I wanted to tell you, how does the royal family fit into all this? Do you visit those places too?
Sorry, can you repeat that question, Amy Louie?
Glenn, yep. How does the British royal family fit into all of your tour itinerary?
We don't visit royal places as such. We do go past Windsor Castle, but we're not really doing purely historical royal tours. We're doing more spiritual pilgrimages.
Yes. My question in particular is, how does the royal sites intertwine or don't intertwine with the sacred sites?
Okay, well,
because I heard, this is kind of some gossip, but that someone in the royal family was very interested in crop circles, and that many of the crop circles are on royal land.
Well, Prince Charles is, I think Prince Charles sometimes gets a bad press, but I think he's a pretty good guy. He's championed organic agriculture for a number of years. He's championed the use of sacred geometry in architecture. I don't know if he said anything publicly about crop circles. I suspect he thinks they're a good thing. Of course, his former wife, the late Princess Diana, was somebody very special who touched the hearts of millions of people around the world. And I think she has... she's played a part in actually gifting Prince William, who will become king, a heart. The royal family, historically, has been very cold-hearted. They haven't shown emotion. They've been very non-communicative with their subjects, really, and all sorts of problems. And every one of the Queen's children has had marital problems. So this generation, I think, is starting to throw off these shackles from it's almost like that family were kept prisoners of their own ethos that had been handed down through the centuries. Prisoners of their own ethos or prisoners of their own philosophy that has been passed down through the centuries. I think they didn't mean or want to be cold. It's just the way that they were brought up and the institutions surrounding them keeps them so divorced from other people.
Isn't that... It sounds like a paradigm for all of us.
There's a good analogy, yes.
In a lot of ways, when we look to celebrities, it's really just a representation of our own psyche.
Yes.
And so we learn lessons. It could be anybody, really, that we're talking about or that we look up to, look down on, or whatever it is. But it often tells a story of ourselves.
I think that's a very good comparison, yes.
So tell me, how does it intertwine? Because a lot of these lands are very intertwined with the sacredness.
Yes, yes. And we can see that, for example, probably the most famous the most famous king of England was probably King Arthur. Everyone knows the story of King Arthur and Guinevere, the Knights of the Round Table, the quest for the Holy Grail. In fact, we do run tours focused on that because, again, as you said, it's really an analogy for what quest are we looking for? How can we search for our own Holy Grail? And King Arthur was born at Tintagel Castle, and on the Arthurian tours that we do, we visit Tintagel. We also visit Glastonbury. Glastonbury is where, within the grounds of Glastonbury Abbey, there's a marker saying this is where King Arthur and Queen Guinevere were buried. We visit there. From the top of Glastonbury Tor, you can look across and see 12 miles away where Camelot was, where King Arthur held court. Again, some people say, well, actually, did these characters exist as historical characters? And, you know, there isn't any conclusive evidence either way. And to me, that actually doesn't matter whether all those characters in the Arthurian story did historically exist, because the real important thing is they contain archetypes that speak to us today. The solar hero, the wise elder, the brave knight, all of these archetypes, the maligned witch, and the word witch has become sort of a negative one in our society, but witches were healers and herbalists in the past, and great people to have in your community. So certainly the Arthurian story is very, very powerful, very tied up with the land, and we draw on the archetypes and the lessons from that because they, as I started off saying in the beginning, they are still available to us today. These archetypes are, the energies are, we can actually enter these sites and do work in the same way that we, the people have done for countless generations. And sometimes people aren't able to make that journey to England. So I think you're probably aware that we, next weekend, we're running our sixth annual conference here in Vermont, entitled Crop Circles, Sacred Landscapes and Spirit Wisdom. And we have nine presenters from both sides of the Atlantic who are going to be sharing their personal experiences, their insights, their wisdom. So those people who aren't necessarily able to make a journey to England can still access this, these wonderful gifts, spiritual gifts we're being given from these sacred sites and from the crop circles.
I'm looking at your website and you have, we talked about most of the main destinations. What is the ancient Fortingall yew tree?
The Fortingall yew tree is in Scotland, and it's a very ancient yew tree, possibly 2,000 years old. And yew trees were revered by our ancestors. They were revered for several reasons.
Okay, why don't we take a break and we'll have Glenn talk about yew trees. I am Emmy Louie, and we're talking about Sacred Britain Tours. And we'll be back. Welcome back. I am Emmy Louie, and I'm here looking at this website called Sacred Britain Tours, and that's www.sacredbritain.com. That's BRITAIN.com. And it says here, come with us to visit the enchanted and magical land of Sacred Britain. Explore mystery and magic on one of our six different tours, visiting the crop circles, ancient sacred sites, holy places, and scenic landscapes of England and Scotland. Visit Stonehenge, Glastonbury, on the Isle of Avalon, Chalice Well, Avebury Stone Circle, Celtic Cornwall, Arthurian sites, Holy Wells, the medieval cities of Winchester and Wells, and other magical spots in England, or see the Knights of Templars, Grail Chapel at Roslyn, the historical city of Edinburgh, magical Glen Lyon, the ancient Fortingall yew tree, magical Mount, I'm not going to say that word, and
Alien,
powerful stone circles in Celtic Scotland. I probably messed up the words. And tell me about the yew tree, Glenn Broughton.
Okay. You actually did very good on your pronunciations there, Emily Ray. Yew tree, if you go into any old churchyard in England, you'll find there are yew trees planted around the walls and of the graveyard and also within the grounds. And the church said it was to ward off evil spirits. But actually that is really a slight perversion of the truth, because the reference to yew trees goes back to the Druids. And the Druids respected and revered yew trees as rebirth and renewal of life, because yew trees live for a long time, and that one at Fortingall is believed to be 2,000 years old. When it finally comes to the end of that long life, as the final leaves fall off and the final sap falls down, descends down the trunk, and the old tree dies, a new growth emerges out of the rotten dust and pulp at the bottom, because as the yew trees die, the center rots and creates this wonderful humus in, within the tree, and these old ones tend to be open, you can walk inside them, and a new bud grows out of this, the out of the ashes of the old. It's like the phoenix, and it starts to grow, and so it's reborn, and then it goes on for another 2,000 years. Now, whether you set it's the same tree or a different tree, it's really the seed of the original tree. So it was revered by the Druids as a sacred tree for that and other reasons. It was also, interestingly, the tree that was used to make the longbows that the archers in medieval times, everyone's heard about Robin Hood, and the bows that they used to use in Robin Hood's times were made from the branches of yew trees because they had such subtlety and wouldn't snap. And there's another clue to its properties, that by working with the energy of the yew tree, you can actually access flexibility within yourself and lead to a rebirth and renewal of your spiritual life.
That sounds like a great explanation. Education on the yew tree. Magnificent. Wow. So how big are your tours, and do you go by, how about going to transportation? Tell me about the facilities that you folks, your tours stay at and all that.
Okay, what we do, we only run small of personal tours. So we have two 17-seater minibuses. I drive one. My wife, Cameron, drives the other one. And each bus has no more than 11 passengers. So 22 in the tour group is the maximum size. And we, all people have to do is get themselves to either Heathrow Airport or an airport in Scotland or Ireland, depending on which tour it is. But we meet people off the plane in the minibuses, and the itinerary is pre-booked. So we book into great top-quality hotels, but old hotels which have character as well as modern facilities. We don't, for example, stay in modern motels. Most of the hotels we stay in are things like 400-year-old coaching inns, which have so much character. Beam ceilings and open fires, lots of history, but all the modern facilities of places we stay have been upgraded. They all have en-suite bathrooms. So everyone has their own bathroom within the space. And then we have people see before they book what the proposed itinerary is, and we guide people to the different sacred sites. And the whole tour sort of builds energy. So we've organized the route and the way we order this visiting a different site, that each one makes sense and builds on the knowledge we have gained at the previous one, so that at the end of it, people have had this a powerful, complete experience, accessing, if you like, connecting with the energies of this very special and ancient land.
What about something as basic as the food? What are some things, if people are interested in touring, what do they expect from the food?
Well, that's a good point, because most people on the second day of the tour say, I really expected the food to be crummy. I'd heard English food was terrible, but this is great. And, you know, English food did used to be bad. 20 years ago, it was pretty plain and boring. But now, with England being part of Europe, it's really improved tremendously. And
you're kidding me, right?
Sorry?
You're kidding me.
No, not at all.
Is it because of the euro? You're not saying because of the euro.
Because of the influence of European cuisine, French cuisine, Italian cuisine, Spanish cuisine that sort of traveled across the channel. And in England now, there's here in the States, there are so many cookery programs on TV because people are really interested in food and want good food. And so things have changed a lot. A lot of people on our tours end up saying, yeah, I didn't realize I was coming on a gourmet food tour.
What about a gourmet beer tour?
Well, the beer in England, I have to say, is fantastic. And if people like trying different beers, the beers in the hotels, and we take people out to pubs to experience an English pub, and people can try some of the great beers that there are there.
So if you don't drink, then...
Sorry?
What if people do not drink
alcohol? If people don't drink...
I mean, it's okay.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my wife normally doesn't drink, we have no issues around drinking or not drinking. Most of the pubs we go to are, there's a reason for being there. For example, one of them is a crop circle pub. We'll go to meet crop circle researchers. Another one is a pub by the side of a beautiful fishing river in the countryside, and so we're seeing the beautiful river running by, and you know, we happen to get some really nice food, and if you want to drink while you're there, fine. And if it's of course, when we're driving, we never drink any alcohol anyway.
That is so neat that you live in Vermont and you have tours in Britain, right?
We live in Vermont in the winter and England in the summer.
Why? Is it so icky in the winter that you don't want to be there? Is that what it is?
It's primarily because my wife, Cameron, is American and has family here, and I'm English and have family there, so we split our time. And, of course, so a lot of people say, you're in Vermont in the winter? You must be crazy. Why aren't you there in the summer? But in the summer, you know, that's when people travel, and that's when we do the tours to Britain.
That sounds absolutely beautiful. That sounds so beautiful. What about the on your own traveling before and after? Do people ever do that? Do they go to London after, or what is it?
Yeah, and we help people with that as much as we can, with information and advice on how to book trains, how to book hotels, where to get information. So we support people to either arrive early or to stay on if they wish to do that.
But, you know, a common thing sometimes when you're traveling is to overdo yourself, because traveling can be, for some people, tiring because you need to wake up at a scheduled time. And for some of our night people, waking up at 7:30 is a stretch.
Mm-hmm. Well, what we always say is nothing on our tours is compulsory. Everything is optional. And we normally, on the crop circle tours, we're in the same hotel the whole time. Sometimes we stay in two different hotels in different parts of the country. The most we stay in is three. So you're not moving every day, which means if people want to take a half day off, they want to take a day off, they can do that. And they can just hang out, they can read, they can journal, they can enjoy the local town that the hotel is in. So if people want to have a lay-in and lazy morning, that's great. It's people's vacation, and they should be able to do exactly what they want to do. That's our philosophy.
Yes, because whenever I tour myself, if I have a lot of things to do, I tend to do less and enjoy more of what I'm seeing versus doing a lot of different things and not really enjoying one thing. A great example is when I went to the, what is that, the Louvre in Paris, and that there's one tour that I think is about 6 hours long.
Yes.
The Louvre, have you been to the Louvre?
I haven't been to the Louvre, no.
And it's so daunting. And at one time I was running through the galleries because you want to see the Mona Lisa and everything. And so there's a one, because there's so many, I'm just using that as an example, but there's so many things to see that we tend to want to see too much and not enjoy one thing.
Well, that's, yes, quite. We always say that we normally do two things in a day. We may visit a crop circle in the morning and one sacred site in the afternoon. We don't believe you can visit six sacred sites in a day and have a meaningful experience at them. If you just want to get your T-shirt, get your postcard stamped and move on to the next one, we aren't the firm to travel with.
That's what I was saying. That is what I am saying. I am, and there's a tendency to do that, to rush through things. Because it's almost like you have a notch and you have a list and it's a to-do list. It's like, okay, I saw this, I saw that, I saw that.
Yes.
And I experienced nothing after.
Right.
And so, and in fact, just one of these places, such as Stonehenge, if done properly, you experience a whole myriad of experiences with one place.
Yes.
Anything else you want to say? We've got two more minutes. Please.
Well, just to remind people again about the conference coming up next weekend. It's in Vermont. It's at Bolton Valley Resort, which is a ski mountain. And it's starting on Friday, November the 2nd. We're starting at midday, and it goes through the weekend until Sunday the 4th. If people are interested in that, they can go to the website that you've mentioned, sacredbritain.com, or telephone 802-425-5616.
And that's on Crop Circles, Sacred Landscapes, and Spirit Wisdom Conference. And this usually occurs the first month, first week of November, is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
And is it also the Crop Circle Conference of the United States, so to speak?
It's the Crop Circle Conference of the East Coast. There's one later in the month on the West Coast. We're the only one taking place on the East Coast. So if you're anywhere from, well, in fact, we do have some people coming from the West Coast, but certainly if you're anywhere from the middle to the east and you're interested in crop circles or sacred landscapes, then it's a conference. Everyone loves coming to the conference. It's a very heart-centered conference, and we're really looking forward to it this year.
Thank you so much, Glenn Broughton, from sacredbritain.com, and he conducts Sacred Britain Tours. I am Emmy Louie. You're listening to the Emmy Louie Show. It was a thank you for being on the show, Glenn.
You're very welcome.
And namaste.